The Absinthe Book Club, Episode 1, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And we are recording.
Yay.
It's official. The inaugural episode of the Absinthe Book Club has begun. Let me go ahead and introduce everybody. With us today, we've got Calvin Cole, stand-up comedian.
Say hi, Calvin.
Hey, how you doing?
Yeah, that's his voice. So you can recognize that. He was
the other male voice.
Yes. And so, you're famous. You did Aspen Festival and Just for Laughs.
Everybody knows about that.
Yeah, you're a big deal. We also have Carrie Scher.
Yes.
Of Weird Hot fame.
Yes, my band, Weird Hot. We're good. Look us up.
And also...
Not Weird Hot fame.
You're...
Weird Hot.
Yeah, she's famous for being weird and...
And hot. But my band also happens to be called Weird Hot.
Right.
We are all both weird and hot as well.
And your blog as well.
CarrieScher.com. Yes.
Yes. So, you can check that out. All right, so today we're drinking absinthe. Cheers, guys.
Let's clink.
Clink.
Yay.
Wow, that was a very audible clink. I like it. We're starting it off. It's delicious.
Goes down nice.
Yeah.
Smoother than you'd think.
And the book for today is Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas by Hunter S. Thompson. All right, I'll start with you. What did you think of the book, Harry?
It's trippy as hell. I've never read Hunter S. Thompson before, so this is my first experience with a Hunter S. Thompson. I did see The Rum Diaries with Johnny Depp that came out, I guess, about a year ago, and that's based on another one of his novels, although not as trippy as this one. I don't know. I thought it was a really well-done book. He's definitely got into his own unique writing style, which I really appreciate. I don't know that it's... It was really just very interesting to me, having not done a whole lot of drugs in my entire life. It was kind of interesting to see, you know...
The whole foray of pretty much everything.
I didn't even know some of these drugs existed. I had no idea.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we'll get into that later on.
Yeah. What did you think, Calvin?
I enjoyed it. I thought it was a pretty easy read in terms of, like, I mean, the language is interesting, but it's so action-packed. Like there's always something going on. It's very tense. Like, I don't know, it kept me on edge the whole time.
Yeah, it's got plenty of those moments where they're either trying to hide how fucked up they are, or they're almost in trouble.
And doing really random, weird shit.
Yeah.
And you're like, what are you doing? Like,
and the like, whether it's real or imagined, they always appear to be in kind of, like, constant danger.
Yes.
Yeah. It's funny.
Yes.
That's one of the things I noticed about it. Well, I wasn't expecting as much of as just, it's, the book is hilarious in a dark kind of way. If you've ever had that experience where you're on something and have to hide it, you can definitely relate to all the stuff going on in this novel. My only trouble with it was it's supposed to be kind of an answer to the 60s counterculture drug movement kind of thing that happened in the 60s, and this came out in 71. So right after that, right as that was coming to an end, and he's like, how that failed is supposed to be kind of encapsulated in this book. Well, I wasn't alive during the 60s, so I...
Nor was I.
...didn't really get that part of it.
Well, what I didn't understand is the heart of the American dream. What does the American dream have to do with Vegas? That's what... I guess the winning a lot of money thing, but, like, to me, the American dream is the ability to come and make something of yourself, even if you know, your background is not this, or your wealth is not this, and, you know, turn it around and make yourself successful. To me, that's what the American dream is, and I just didn't really understand.
I think the point that he's making is that Vegas represents what the American dream has been perverted into.
Oh.
At that point in history, where it's, like, it's so trashy and kind of cliched and, like, gross and kind of bloated.
Yeah.
And it's fake. Like, the whole thing's fake. And I think that's the point. It's kind of rotted from the inside out. And that's what he's discovering at the tail end of those times where there was so much, like, hope and so much, like, happening. And he talks about, like, the excitement of that time and how no matter where you went, you knew something was going on. And now it's just, like the world he's in now is so violent and hateful, and it just seems like none of that mattered.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it's supposed to be. Well said. Yeah, it's definitely kind of like I said, it's well written. I like the way he writes, but it's also disjointed. Like, it's not like a typical novel in that it kind of builds towards anything. There's no like climax as much.
Yeah, it's like this is happening and now this is happening and then now this is happening and now this is happening.
Yeah, it's just sort of a series of events.
Yeah.
And I mean, I felt that the ending was kind of anticlimactic.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
a sort of like, I mean, it's the trip is literally over. Like, it's physically over. He's leaving it. And so that's the end
then,
of the book.
Yeah.
Because it's presented as a sort of travelogue or whatever.
Yeah.
But it seemed almost arbitrary. Like, nothing was really resolved. And it was certainly not the most exciting part of the book, like, by far. And, like, there was no wrap-up.
Yeah, there was no big, yeah. What I thought that was interesting, I don't know where you guys bought the book. Where I bought it was at Barnes & Noble, and it wasn't in, you know, fiction section. It was in, like, the journalism and media section, which I thought was interesting.
This book is very much based on reality. I looked into that a little bit.
Did you? Yeah, because I was curious about that, because I thought that it was
what
more
happened,
or less fiction.
Hunter S. Thompson went with his
attorney?
Mexican attorney friend. I don't know if it was his actual representative.
Mexican or Samoan?
Mexican.
Oh, okay.
So,
some details have been changed to protect the innocent.
Yeah, they changed
the
names, obviously.
I read up
a
little on that, too. It's sort of like a fictionalized.
Yeah, what they did, they were actually going to cover the Men 400 for Sports Illustrated.
Oh, okay.
And then what he wrote was kind of, I guess, the precursor of this book, and he turned that into Sports Illustrated.
Oh.
And they rejected it.
Yeah, I can imagine.
As hard as they could. And then later it got picked up by Rolling Stone. So it is kind of based in reality.
I think I read somewhere that he talked about, because in the book he refers to himself by a pseudonym.
Yeah, but they don't even say his name until more than halfway through the book. I didn't ever pick it. It's like Duke, right?
Yeah, and it's weird because they keep hinting that he's really Hunter S. Thompson, and like it's... I don't know, his identity is really ambiguous. Like, you can't tell if it's Hunter S. Thompson using a pseudonym or the other way around.
Yeah.
Or if, like, Hunter S. Thompson is this other actual person that he's, like, sort of half stolen his identity. And I know that he, in later life, felt like he, people didn't understand who was who. Because this is obviously a little bit exaggerated, like, about, you know, his behavior and whatnot. And people kind of expected this guy when they met him.
Yeah.
So the real Hunter S. Thompson was a little bit more put together than this guy in the book?
No.
No.
No, he was... I did some research on that as well. He was pretty crazy. One of my favorite things I discovered. He ran for sheriff of Aspen, Colorado.
Yeah, yeah.
In 1970.
Barely lost.
Yeah. One of my favorite things, he actually shaved his head so he could refer to his opponent as my long-haired opponent. but his... principles. He was going to change the name of Aspen to Fat City. That was one thing he wanted to do.
Like F-A-T?
F-A-T.
Do you know why?
Yeah, to call out greedy people. Something like
that. Okay, okay.
He said, it will be the general philosophy of the sheriff's office that no drug worth taking shall be sold for money. He also said, my first act will be to install on the sheriff's lawn a set of stocks to punish dishonest drug dealers. So...
more personal
interesting
issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
he was definitely a character. Like, he was kind of a gun nut.
That's really interesting because like you the type of like obvious liberalism he has for so many things you don't associate
with
like
guns.
Gun rights.
Yeah,
but that's what I think is so interesting about him, is that he's not really he's not easily categorized in terms of like politics, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
But,
he actually he covered a lot of political races, but
yeah,
and he did slant liberal, hardcore. But I think,
I think lines were easier to draw in those times too. Like I think, like from where he was standing, it was a good and evil type of issue.
Yeah,
the gun rights stands out. Like
to him, I guess it was more like a freedom issue. Like,
yeah, yeah.
I don't want the government telling me I can't
have guns
things.
And take all the drugs.
Yeah,
and an individualism thing. And I guess, I don't know, it seems to me like the original idea behind the right to bear arms was to protect yourself against the government.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe that's what he's thinking about.
Yeah. I think it's, I wonder how much of the book is actually true. Like, what happened in the book that really happened? Because it's not like he is building towards anything. So he wouldn't have to make anything up just for
dramatic effect necessarily.
Yeah.
So you gotta wonder. It's like, wow. I mean, how many bars of Neutrogena is soap? I mean, we're allowed to reveal details.
Yeah, yeah.
Way.
Go for it. Let's
like just
spoilers go.
Yeah.
Spoiler
no,
alert. We're gonna
were they,
have lots of spoilers.
They were. I guess they were on some sort of drug cocktail concoction and had gotten from the maids in the hotel. What was it? 100, 200.
Several hundred. Yeah.
Bars
of soap.
Bars of Neutrogena soap.
And grapefruits.
And the grapefruits, which I guess apparently if anybody's an avid drug user, I guess if you follow it up with like grapefruit juice and grapefruit, the vitamin C helps to, I guess, keep you from dying, I guess, after you...
Vitamin C for acid is, I think it makes it come down easier.
Oh, okay.
Something
interesting.
Like or it just tastes great.
I can't remember.
Something.
Interesting.
Yeah. I thought, speaking of like how much is true and how much isn't, I thought it was really interesting that the his editor is kind of a character in the book.
Yeah.
Because he interjects so, I won't say often, but like so strongly, where it's like the editor has a definite voice in the book at times, and that makes it, I don't know, that even. That muddies the subject even more because you're not sure, like, did Hunter S. Thompson write these editor's notes into his own book, or is this an actual intervention by the editor? I mean, you have to assume that it's a device that he's using, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it would go to print without those things just being corrected, as opposed to... I mean, because it's set up almost like the editor had to make these decisions because the author was maybe, like just had dropped off the face of the earth.
Yeah, there was even that whole chapter where it was
just a transcript off the recording. Yeah,
yeah,
that's what I'm thinking of mostly.
What were some of your favorite parts of the book, Callum?
I really liked the relationship between himself and his lawyer. They had kind of an endearing, like a really functional chemistry in that, like they were both obviously like really fucked up all the time, but. They were peas in a pod, like when everything was kind of going okay, and they were able to fight and whatnot. But as soon as anything became like really got to the brink of this is an actual problem, one of them had like a shining moment of competence, and like kind of saves the other one. Like
they
save each other's bacon all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of them always pulls through, so that even though so much of the book the attorney seems to be creating more problems and more turmoil, and he's it kind of puts you on edge because he, at times he seems even dangerous. But then, on the weird flip side of that, there's a couple of times where he just leaves and then comes back and then leaves again. And the hunter or the main character is alone in Vegas. And I find that those periods where he's by himself are even more stressful because even though the lawyer is such a wild card, you kind of have this feeling like, well, as long as they're together, one of them will pull it out of their ass.
Can talk the other one,
yeah,
talk them out of whatever they get into.
Yeah.
To some degree. Like, I remember the part where they're at Circus, and the attorney, he gets in, like, a fight at the bar or something, and then it turns out it was...
Well, Hunter has to, like, shove him off the carousel.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying is, like, it's not always the attorney coming through, but also, like, sometimes... When the attorney is so far gone, it kind of steals, the protagonist, where he's like, he kind of takes over and goes into boss mode because he has to help this guy.
Yeah,
and kind of pulls it together.
Yeah, one of my favorite parts was in part one, and it was the part where the attorney's in the bathtub, and he insists on trying to kill himself to the instrumental
White Rabbit.
The instrumental climax of White Rabbit. And so instead of dropping he was going to drop a toaster or something
into the
bathtub, he drops one of the grapefruit, a couple of the grapefruits, and the guy that was one of that I thought that scene was really funny.
Yeah,
I said there were so many moments like that where they were just hilarious. This book,
well, everything's at such a high pitch all the time that
I mean,
he drives everything to its most absurd, like, conclusion.
Yeah.
how do you not die? And, like, I just don't, that's what I had the biggest trouble reconciling. I was like, how are you not dead?
That was the, what was interesting to me, too, when we talked about the ending. It was kind of anticlimactic. Like, reading the whole book, I was thinking, like,
well, something big's gonna happen. Yeah.
They're gonna get caught, and that's gonna kind of be how things work. And then they never do. Like, just, what is it, 4 days of just absolute depravity.
Yeah.
And doing everything illegal.
That, isn't it?
Or is it 5 days?
I thought it was more
everything
well,
illegal under
because
the sun.
It becomes longer because they stay around for the conference. I think it's like a week or a little more.
Yeah.
Originally, they're covering the biker.
The Mint 400.
Yeah. And then they go to cover the cop convention.
Yeah. Well, it's the narcotics, the drug narcotics convention, which is a nice, like, twist of irony.
I love when they're talking to that cop at the bar.
Oh, when they tell him the story. What do they tell him? The horrible story about how they cut people's heads off.
Yeah.
The 16-year-old. Just making shit up all over the place. We can curse
and the guy.
Stage.
Of course.
But what's funny is that the cop, like, not just believes it, but seems to, like, kind of want to believe it. Like, he didn't want to admit it, but he sort of expected this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. They just really, like, messing with him in his small town, kind of.
Yeah, they do a lot of that. Like, it seems almost unnecessary provocation.
It seems like every other character they interact with. Everything they say to them is a lie.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, often for no reason.
Yeah.
Just, yeah, interesting. Okay, so not to bring it back to the drug thing, but also to bring it back to the fiction versus nonfiction thing, like, is it even physically, like, physiologically possible to take this many drugs and survive? Like, that's, what is it, mescaline, methadone,
acid,
LSD. What was that weird adrenal drug? Who knew that existed? Does that even exist?
Like actual adrenal, like
hormones.
Adrenal
you have to actually
fluid that
drain
you,
it from
some
from
gland,
somebody
from
who's alive.
Human
adrenal
gland. I don't know if that's real. Probably is real.
I mean, like you could literally do that.
Yeah,
it doesn't sound like something that happens a lot.
No,
but yeah, I don't know. I mean. I'm sure that exaggerations were made, but on the other hand, I mean, he throws in a little, like, brief kind of justification for it where he talks about going to see his doctor and how the guy told him, you should be dead.
Yeah.
And the guy, he's like, I'm sweating too much. He's like, you come see me if you stop sweating.
If you,
yeah.
Because
yeah,
it's probably
sweating.
The only thing keeping you alive.
Yeah.
So, like, him being in the desert and sweating constantly, I guess, is the rationalization for why he's alive.
Yeah. I mean, but in reality, Hunter S. Thompson was notorious for doing all kinds of drugs his whole career.
Did all the drugs.
I watched, there's a YouTube video of him on Letterman. And he's kind of one of those guys, like, I don't think he was actually on anything at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But just the way he talks, it always just kind of sounds like,
he's on something?
He's just permanently got that. I did a lot of drugs.
Sort of.
I met people like that, you know?
Yeah, Tommy Chong thing.
Yeah. he died in 2005.
Yeah.
Well,
he killed himself.
Yeah.
And one of the things I read is that, like, his whole life he was saying he was going to kill himself. Like, that's how I'll go. And then he did. Like, that's...
I think the quote was something like, man, I'm forgetting it now, but it's something about how, like, he would be really sad if he thought that he couldn't just end it at any moment. Like, it was...
Yeah.
Like, he was in control of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, he wasn't, I don't know, afraid to do it, I guess.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess...
He was notorious for choosing with a lot of celebrities, too. Seemed like
I know, like, all
Johnny
the people that
Depp,
played him...
He was friends with Johnny Depp in real life.
Bill Murray, too, who had played him in an earlier movie.
Where
the Buffalo Roam.
Oh, okay.
It was him and the attorney was played by Jeffrey Tambor.
Wow.
Oh, from Arrested Development.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
So I watched it so long ago, and I had no clue what I was watching or, like, who Hunter S. Thompson was, so I didn't absorb, like, any of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'd love to go back and watch it again, because I really like Bill Murray a lot.
Yeah.
And well, and Jeffrey Tambor, too.
Has anyone seen the movie of this?
I saw parts of it at some point, but I never
I'm ashamed
watched the whole
that
thing.
I watched, like, the first half of it. I love Terry Gilliam, the guy who directed it. I mean, everyone involved with it is, like, my favorite. And I haven't sat and watched the whole thing beginning to end.
Yeah.
No, I never. I mean, I just remember watching parts of it when I guess it came out. So I was, probably 14 at the time. 13 to 14 and being like, what in the hell is going on? What?
Yeah,
I don't care.
I think...
It's like, I couldn't follow it. I feel like now, having read the book, if I watched the movie, I'd probably be a lot more apt to kind of
Yeah.
I just didn't understand what all the cartoon character illustrations and everything that come out of their head. Johnny Depp and Benicio del Toro's, like, I don't know.
I think that's part of what's so interesting about him is when you read the book, like he's got such a bizarre style, but it's somehow accessible on the page. And as soon as it's translated into a visual medium, it's like I don't even know how to put this in like a context for myself.
Yeah, you can't take the nuance of like his language. Like I don't know if anybody saw the Rum Diaries, but
Yeah, it wasn't. I'm gonna imagine the book was better. I did see the movie.
I mean, Johnny Depp's a great actor, and like he does make the character interesting, you know. But it's just.
There are definitely some very funny scenes of that movie. I imagine the book was probably, knowing his writing style, that it was very funny. It's also about a journalist too. I wonder if that one has any autobiographical.
Yeah.
The Rum Diary, yeah. Because he did go
It was actually, and it was actually written, I think, before this, but wasn't published until, like, 10 years ago or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Another thing he did, Hunter S. Thompson, is he ran with the Hell's Angels.
I did read about that.
And
that's kind of how he got famous.
Yeah, that was his first book, was about the Hell's Angels. Because, I mean, that's... My understanding of the 60s is there was this kind of the status quo versus the non-status quo.
Mm-hmm.
And then the non-status quo, there was kind of the hippies and then, like, the bikers. And the big difference, the bikers were obviously more violent.
Yeah. He talks about that a little in this book, too, where there's that, like, moment where, like, those two groups, I think you call them, like, the greasers and the hippies or something like that, or the gearheads or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But, like, these two sort of strains of the counterculture, and people had been trying to reconcile them for so long, and then they finally just, there was just no putting the two together.
Yeah.
And I guess he was kind of using that as, like, he saw that as sort of the beginning of the end for the whole counterculture movement.
You know what this book reminded me of a lot was On the Road by Jack Kerouac. I don't know if you guys have ever read that one, but
that's another travelogue, though.
Yeah, it's travelogue in the same kind of style. There's no real building, you know, the story.
Traditional story plot structure.
That book is not as much about drugs, but just like living life to the fullest and excess and, you know, going all sorts of crazy. But it seems
to the wall.
You know, and like I said, I wasn't alive, so I don't have the historical context, but it seems like to me that book almost like kind of started the 60s culture where they were... like the beatniks led to the hippies.
Yeah.
Beatniks from the 50s led to the hippies. And like the Allen Ginsberg, Howl, and Jack Kerouac was part of that whole scene. And then it turned into the 60s. And then when the 70s came around, like there was almost like a backlash. And I think that's kind of what this book is about.
Well, what's funny is when he describes the cops at the narcotics and at the narcotics conference, when he goes back to Vegas to also cover this, you know, cop conference.
Yeah.
He talks about what the guys that are giving the lectures are saying and how completely out of touch they are with the real I guess drug culture that was actually going on at the time, at least in his life.
Yeah. His complaint was that he didn't learn anything.
Yeah. I know when they're talking to the cop about how, you know, they smoke weed and then, you know, cut people's heads off, like the Satanists that smoke weed and then, you know, kidnap waitresses and cut their heads off in parking lots in some sort of weird satanic ritual, and the cop is, like, eating up every single word of it and, you know, has no idea that, like, weed's not going to make you do that, bro, you know?
Yeah.
And again, it's, like, you get the impression that all of these guys, like, it's kind of what they're waiting to hear.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They want to hear the worst. They want to know, you know, like, that, you know, it's the devil.
Yeah. And I think that's...
all drugs are the devil.
That's part of this, like, kind of perspective he has, that this world he creates where there's, like, a real, like, conflict, like an open conflict between, like, these two sort of groups of people. And I guess the cops represent the norm or whatever. And I think he brings up Nixon a lot. Right.
Yeah.
And I think these are the people that elected Nixon.
Yeah.
And he's running the country.
Because he hated Nixon in real life too, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Passionately.
Yeah. And Nixon represents these these horrible, like, angry, violent people that don't understand what the hell's going on.
Yeah, they want to believe the worst.
Yeah, mostly, I'll come clean. Most of what I know about Hunter S. Thompson came from a documentary called Gonzo. Mm. But
is that on Netflix?
Yes.
It's currently on live streaming on Netflix.
Yes, that's how I watched it, actually.
Oh, I'll have to check that out.
But it was all about his life. And actually, he's credited with Gonzo journalism is what they call it.
Yes, I knew that was the term that he had kind of invented.
Just turned into a porn thing now, too. But
it's a porn thing?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Gonzo porn? What is Gonzo porn?
Well,
first of all, let's define what Gonzo journalism is for the listeners. Gonzo journalism is... Take it away.
I've had too much
absinthe to be articulate at this moment.
I guess it's journalism that's where you're putting yourself in the situation.
It's like hyper subjective and like based on personal experience, like living the story, as opposed to just observing and commenting on it.
Yes.
So you can take that as porn however you want.
Well, no, then explain, how does that, Gonzo porn would be porn from the perspective of,
yeah, I guess.
The person in the porn?
I honestly don't know. I've never... The name turns me off, so I've never really clicked on it.
Oh. Yeah. It sounds like a
I know what
a
I
Muppet.
Like. I don't really do a lot of exploring.
I'm not a... I wouldn't want to see the Muppets in porn. That would throw me off.
Yeah, right? Gonzo. Yeah.
But that character is, I believe, loosely based on Hunter S. Thompson.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't know that either.
Well, just the erratic behavior, like the Carpe Diem philosophy. I don't know.
Yeah.
And of course the timing. I mean, Muppets were big in the '70s, no?
Yeah, actually.
Yeah.
You're probably right. Animal, I guess, would be the attorney.
That's pretty racist.
Hey.
Oh.
No, it's not. I don't know. Animal isn't supposed to be any kind of a race. Come on now. It's a kid's show.
Just because Animal is the craziest motherfucker of the Muppets, right?
Yeah, he's. Yeah, he's cool.
Yeah. He's good at drums, which is awesome.
I don't know that they ever mentioned the attorney can play any instruments, but you gotta wonder how he became a freaking attorney, because, you know, that presumably requires a lot of skill and, like, you know, I don't know. It just, something that's such a straight-laced job. Like, journalism, I can see, is kind of, you know,
well,
hip and whatever, but...
At one point, they kind of tipped that...
he's not really an attorney?
Well, I think he is, but I think he's like a, like Yellow Pages, like defense hack.
Oh, like.
Like he, like they talked about his typical client who is like
a drug
like
lord.
A multiple offender,
yeah.
Like murderer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. They. What I read about him, actually, the real character that it's based on was like a activist for Mexican rights and
that's cool
stuff like that. So. Yeah.
Well, not very well portrayed then.
No, he's not represented well there.
But probably more interesting in this sense.
Yeah. He's, I find it fascinating that... I just want to tell everyone that, as your attorney, I advise you to drink more absinthe and get more shit-faced.
Cheers to that.
I'm gonna use that constantly for the rest of my life, I think. As your attorney...
Well, I think it's interesting, too, that he also, like, he serves the function of kind of representing all minorities.
Yeah.
Like, he's based on a Mexican. They say he's Samoan, but he's, as far as everyone else in the book is concerned, he's, like, the black guy.
Yeah.
So he's just, like, the person of color, and he represents, like, all of the, like, anger that, like, both that he has toward white people and vice versa, and like the fear and suspicion and it's funny that he's like in there and provides this racial element, but even like Hunter's like whatever doppelganger in the book is so insensitive about it. I don't know. I hadn't thought ahead about the race thing. I should put more thought into that.
Yeah.
But I don't know. That'd be an interesting thing to analyze.
So the car, that's another thing we can talk about.
Well, there's two cars.
Yeah,
two
they
cars.
Start off with the red one.
What do they call it in the book?
The Great Shark?
No,
the white, the shark is the...
Is the Cadillac.
Cadillac, right.
And then the red Corvette.
Is
I bring it up because I think it does kind of symbolize, like we were talking about, how the American dream, things like that. Like, the car is part of that.
Big time.
And the way that they're treating the car.
Well, there's a moment when the second car rental agency tries to put him in, like, a Mercedes or something, and he flips out and demands an American car. So, yeah, these, like, giant, like, gas-guzzling convertibles. Like, the Cadillac at one point was, like, the coup de grace car.
Yeah, the Red Shark. It's the Red Shark is what the first car is called.
And the Great White, right?
Great White, yeah.
So they're
both sharks.
They're both sharks. Mm. There we go. Yeah, like, with a trunk full of drugs. It really epitomizes everything.
And grapefruits.
And firing, like firing a giant gun into
the
wilderness.
Yeah.
And they talk about when, like, and they're talking about, like, how they're just so easily, they're just going 100 on the freeway, like 100 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So.
And then he gets pulled over and nothing.
His interaction with that police officer is one of the most interesting parts of the book for me. I think it's really funny and fascinating. Like, it's the idea, because he's, you imagine that he might not be wrong. Like, the way he thinks about police officers, for starters, that, you know, the first thing people normally do is they start apologizing and talking about how they were wrong. And I forget the quote, is something like, it arouses contempt in the cop heart.
Yeah.
Something like that. Where it's like, they instantly see you as, like, this worm. Whereas if you treat them as your equal, things go a lot differently.
So what he does, instead of pulling over immediately when he's when the cop comes behind him with his lights on, he flashes his blinker, but he jumps on the gas and goes all the way to the next exit. Pulls off with a harebrained turn and, like, almost flips the car, but he's expecting it, the cop's not, so then the cop is freaking out, and he gets out of the car, and he's, like, all mad at the guy, but realizes he was doing the right thing all along.
Right, he was just in the act of pulling over, and he's standing outside the car, like, with his license and registration.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Ready to go.
Like, what's the problem? Yeah, except that, in this case, he's holding an open container.
Yeah, he's got the can of beer.
Yeah, and he's got
that changes everything.
It changes nothing, because he doesn't actually, there's still no repercussions.
Yeah, it's funny. They're never held accountable for any of the shit that they pulled.
Yeah. Maybe that's the American dream.
Yeah,
to
maybe
just
that's
get away
with
everything you want to get away with.
Well, I think that is a major theme in the book, is that they basically kind of, like, talk and lie and cheat their way into and out of all sorts of things. And I think it's less about what they're doing and more about the way everyone else is kind of treating them. Because it's all, like, there's so often it's, you know, like, this, they're talking to someone who, it's not that they're so snowed over by their explanation, it's that they just don't want to deal with it. And if you give them enough of an out, they will just kind of turn a blind eye to whatever's going on so that they don't have to, like, deal with it, basically.
Yeah.
And that happens over and over again, where people, like, so much of this book is people seeing what they want to see, or hearing what they want to hear, and ignoring the truth of what's happening. And I think the main character sees himself as one of the only people who sees what's going on, despite the fact that so often his perception is so, like, warped by not just the drugs, but the way he seems to view the world.
That is such a good point. So why don't we move on from there, I think.
Okay.
So we'll go on to, recommendations. What we do here is we each come up with something that we want to recommend to our listeners that they might not have heard of otherwise. Do you want to start?
I will start. And you know what? Honestly, I have a wide variety of interests and fields of expertise and things that I'm interested in. However, I'm taking the easy way out, and I'm going to recommend my band. My band's website, weirdhot.net. Check us out. We're really good rock music. It's unoffensive, but very original and kind of based on sort of the 70s and 80s glam rock, sort of punk, rock and roll, you know, you can dance to everything. Once again, that's weirdhot.net. Check us out. We're playing in Philadelphia, Tuesday, November 20th, December 1st, and December 29th at Johnny Brenda's.
You know, you get a chance for shameless plugs, right? we'll be adding those later.
Oh, I have another. Oh no, don't worry. I have something for my shameless plug as well.
Okay.
That is even more self-serving than my recommendation.
All right, I like it. What do you got, Calvin?
So plugs later.
Yeah, plugs later.
Plugs later. Okay. For my recommendation, I will say I'm a big movie fan. So you said anything, regardless of reading or not reading. So my favorite television show of all time is Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Ooh, awesome! Yeah,
it's great.
That show's great.
So obviously, I recommend the show, but since it's been off the air for a decade, let me recommend, because it's still happening, rifftracks.com.
I have friends that are into it.
So good. Okay, so the three, the head writer and two of the main writers and characters from the show, Michael J. Nelson, Bill Corbett, and Kevin.
Third guy from
Flavor Thompson. But yeah, anyway, what they do now is basically the same thing. I mean, they drop the overarching plot, but it's them ripping on movies. But instead of just doing really old movies that they could buy the rights to for their television show, now what they do is rip on any possible movie, blockbusters, huge, like, you know, whatever's in the theaters and so on. And what they do is record their commentaries in MP3, and you can buy it off their website, very cheap. And then all you have to do is have a copy of the movie, and you sync up the sound, and they're right there with you, making fun of this movie better than you and your lame friends can do. So I highly recommend it, and I love those guys, and you should give them all your money. And they do, like, kind of monthly, I guess, they'll do where they'll riff a movie live and, like, stream it to different, like, movie theaters. So you can actually buy a ticket, go sit in a theater, which I've done multiple times,
wow.
Like at a Regal or whatever, and watch them riff on a movie live, which is a lot of fun. Highly recommend.
That's pretty awesome. See, that's a good one.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah.
Now
see,
I
that's,
do.
That's
now
why
now
we
I
do this.
Yes.
Check
right,
it
anyway.
Out. Mine, I was going to recommend, I read a book by Paul Auster. It's called Sunset Park. I'm going to be book
my
guy.
Girlfriend used to live in Sunset Park.
Park book. Yeah. It's a,
is it actually based in Sunset Park,
Brooklyn? It takes place in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. That's why it's called Sunset Park. Maybe, I mean, that's part of why I liked it, because I live
familiar.
Near that area, and he mentions a lot of spots that I've been to, but it's also kind of an interesting story about a guy who abandons his family, his rich family, leaves, goes and starts a new life, and then winds up coming back broke and living in a rundown place in Sunset Park. They're squatting in an apartment there. And it's really interesting, and I enjoyed it. There's some random sex stuff that's kind of out of the blue, so
nice.
Warning about that. But it's pretty good. So that's mine. So, drinking game. Let's write a drinking game for Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. So those of you familiar with the old college drinking game, obviously it's mostly to movies where if anytime something happens, specific happens, you drink. So you want to pick something that happens often in the movie. So in this case, we're going to do it for books. Although I will say it's kind of hard to read and drink at the same time. So this
nonsense.
Is
nonsense. I do it all the time.
I have no idea what you're talking about. It's the stupidest thing you've ever said.
I don't know. Sometimes when I get drunk and try to read, it winds up a big mess.
You know, it's funny. I actually, not to veer off the subject, but when I finished this book, I came home and I was a little tipsy from having been out. And I can't tell you, I mean, I enjoyed it even more.
All right.
Being
a
little under the
problem.
Influence by when reading.
So you can't actually drink to
this. Yes, you can actually drink to this.
And there is the air conditioning system.
Yes,
Jesus.
Yes. Just so you know, we are very cool and warm and very comfortable in this
I've
setting.
I've said, New York, you don't get central air.
Yeah.
Which, coming from by way of Florida, was a shock.
Welcome to Philadelphia.
Yeah.
We have central Spank. Air and parking spots, and just as many cool people, without all the bad ones.
Yes, we're recording this in Philly. Northern Liberties is the neighborhood.
Northern Liberties is my neighborhood, and I love it. Anyway, so if we're going to do a drinking game for Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, the good thing about this is it is a book as well as a movie. So our drinking game for reading can also be for watching.
That's true. I would probably apply.
So it's a double. It's a
I don't know how much
drinking game.
Is like I said, I haven't really watched the movie all the way through, so I don't know how much actually crosses over, but I assume it's enough to make a drinking game worthwhile.
My drinking game for this, I don't know, I'm kind of on the fence. I have a couple. So the first one I was thinking of is every time that one of them does a drug that you've done yourself, like shotgun a beer or something, or take a you know, double shot of whiskey or bourbon or vodka or whatever your preferred liquor of choice is. And then the other one that I was thinking of was every time there's a grapefruit, every time you see a grapefruit, or somebody mentions a dwarf, or you see a dwarf, or a dwarf.
The dwarf with the phone is a very, I love the...
It's such great imagery.
Weird, like, yeah, mystery.
All of
that.
The people, they're such, it's really good imagery of the people. I'm actually curious to see the movie now, just to see what they all, like, you know, translated, what they look like.
Here's a fun one. So, I don't know, I actually read mine on a Kindle, which is a weird way to read a book and then talk about it because sometimes format is an issue, but do all of the copies have like the illustrations?
Yes. Assume so. My copy had all the illustrations.
Yeah,
I have the same copy you did.
I was gonna say it might be fun to like every time there's an illustration, like stop, take a shot, and like, you know, take a couple extra seconds to appreciate the artwork and then get back to the text.
Yeah, Lex, do you have any fun facts about the illustrator or what the story is behind the illustrations or anything?
Has he worked with Hunter S. Thompson on multiple books, I believe?
Yes, he was in that documentary I mentioned, Gonzo.
Okay.
I forget, his name's in the book there.
Yeah, no, I'll pull up his name right now. He signs all of the illustrations.
Yeah.
Or except for the one that I'm currently looking at, just a moment. Let me find him another one. It's like Paul Rutherford or something like that. I feel like, no, Ralph Steadman.
Ralph Steadman.
That sounds nothing like Paul Rutherford.
So there are some excellent illustrations in this book.
And I'm not going to shit on Kindle because I love the Kindle and it's great for like the subway and whatnot being in New York. But I will say, just looking at this paper copy of the book, the illustrations are much more effective.
Are they?
On the page.
Yeah.
Although I read a lot of this while I was at work.
Yeah.
And those illustrations, not safe for work.
Not safe for work.
You know, people vomiting and naked and...
Yeah, I mean, it's very obviously, it's like, it's not supposed
to
look realistic.
Yeah, it's not realistic.
No, but it's almost, I mean, like, realistic might have been less disturbing, actually.
Yeah,
it's,
I agree. I think that's why
it's kind of horrific.
Even the ones that aren't, like, vulgar in a literal sense are definitely off-putting.
The one that I'm looking at right now, there's a whole bunch of overweight...
Lizard,
dinosaur...
Skulls wading through a pool of blood,
which is one of his hallucinations.
I do remember that scene is in the film.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. So good, we got that. Mine, I'm going to say anytime he says, as your attorney, I recommend you to following. So you can think in your head, as your attorney, I recommend you take a drink. Right?
Like
just did.
It's
like
worth
that.
Getting a legal degree for me, just so I can say that to people.
As
your attorney, I recommend you do that. All right, so now what we always do, this is the first podcast, but...
Cool, this is what we always
intend to always do. Is we're going to play the author title game. So let me explain this. It's a little complicated. Not that complicated. I shouldn't say complicated.
You explained it to me earlier, and I don't get it or remember getting it.
Okay, so you're going to get it right now, because we're going to play. All
right.
What I do is I give you an author... And then you try to name as many books by that author as you can. So you say, okay. So it's you want to name as many books by that specific author as you can. This is general book knowledge. Has nothing to do with Fear and Loathing. So what I'll do is if I say, if I said J.R.R. Tolkien, which is not our example, you could say
The Hobbit. Lord of the Rings.
Blah, 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 blah.
Sequels can.
How many can you name? And you could probably name four of those,
Lord of
right?
the Rings 1, 2, and 3, and The Hobbit.
Yeah, you can't say Lord of the Rings 1, 2, and 3.
Whatever.
That's kind of cheap.
I'm a nerd. I know the names.
Okay. I'm a nerd, too. So that is going to be kind of how it works. But before you get your opportunity to do that, what you're going to do is wager how many names you think you can name by a certain author, and you're not going to...
You're not going to know who the author is.
I'm not going to give you the author's names. However, I will give you some hints about the author.
Oh, okay.
But I will say, if you get who the author is based on the hints, don't say it out loud, because the other person can make it. So, if I said J.R.R. Tolkien, and you... Or, before I went, I would say, let's give some hints about J.R.R. Tolkien, blah, blah, blah. He wrote a lot of fantasy books, and you could say, I can name four books.
Yeah.
And then I would say, okay, J.R.R. Tolkien.
And then I would have to name them.
Okay. So, author number one.
So, is it me first
and then him, or do we...
Whoever wagers the more books gets the shot?
Yes. So what's going to happen...
So we don't both get to go.
Okay.
So if you wager... So you'll get... action is to you first, and then the next round the action will be to Calvin. So if you can wager... I'll give you the author. You can wager a certain number of books. If you think you can beat that, then you wager more. If you don't think you can beat that, you say name.
Okay.
Okay? And I'll say this. If you are able to guess the author without me giving it to you...
Don't say it.
That counts... as a book, but don't say it until it's actually your turn.
Okay.
So if you wager three books, you're able to get the author in two books. That counts.
Okay.
Fascinating. Okay.
Have we got it?
Yes.
All right. It sounds more complicated than it is when we play.
Yeah, this is something
I'm gonna get
by doing.
So okay. I'm the guy that always like demands to read all the directions before a board game begins. So this is good for me.
That's unfortunate for you.
Well, it's more unfortunate for the other people waiting to play the game.
And the air conditioning's gone, so that's going to make this game even more fun.
So now this is usable.
Yeah, people can actually hear us. Okay, so author number one was alive from 1812 to 1870. He was English. This is what BBC History had to say about him. The author himself is a rags-to-riches story, started in poverty. This man became the quintessential Victorian author. His epic stories, vivid characters, and exhaustive depiction of contemporary life are unforgettable. And one quote from the author, "A day wasted on others is not wasted on oneself." Okay? How many books do you think you can name by this author?
At least three.
Wow, okay.
You go ahead then.
I feel like I know who the author is.
Okay.
Can I say it?
So you go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is it Charles Dickens?
You got it.
Yes. Tale of Two Cities, Nicholas Nickleby.
Wow.
And then I got the author, so that's three.
Yeah, that is three. You could have also said, obviously, did you say Oliver Twist?
I did not say Oliver Twist.
Christmas Carol. Those are the big ones.
Well, that's
Prince
obvious.
Of the Popper.
Great Expectations was a big one. I'm pretty impressed right now.
You know,
well,
it's
done.
Funny. You know what's really funny? And maybe I'm just having a psychic moment, but when you were actually, even before you brought up Tolkien, I was actually just going to shoot out Dickens, because I was like, oh, there's no way he has that on his list. Because that's just an author that had popped into my head randomly.
Yeah, fuck you.
So then when you were giving over the clues,
I was like, that checks out. I had no idea that she knew anything about Charles
Dickens.
I'm
not a complete idiot, contrary to popular belief of the people in this room.
You are related to me, so I hope so. Okay, so now you have 1 point. First person to 2 points gets to pick. Actually, why don't we say what we're playing for? So what we're playing for, whoever wins this game gets to pick the next book that we read. Okay, so what book would you pick? Now you have 1 point and are in the lead.
Can I tell you? What
please.
World War Z, because I love zombies.
Okay, World War Z is what Carrie is playing for. What are you playing for, Calvin?
I was going to do Our Man in Havana by Graham Greene.
Our Man in Havana by Graham Greene.
He's one of the beat writers, right?
Well, he's...
Beatnik writers?
No, he's an Englishman. He was pretty straight-laced. I mean, he had lots of affairs, but... No, he did a lot of,
Was he alive in, the 50s and 60s, though?
Well, he was alive for almost the entire 20th century.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
So, yes.
He did, Orient Express and... Brighton Rock and The Quiet American.
Okay. Cool. That sounds good. All right, so, action is to you this time. Author number two... he was born in 1962, still alive. He's American. This is what Wikipedia has to say. This man has had two feature films made from his novels. He describes his writing style as transgressional fiction. One quote, don't guess yet.
Okay.
One quote from the author, "If you don't know what you want, you end up with a lot you don't." He's written 13 novels. How many can you name?
I think I can, if I'm thinking of the right person, then I can name, four if I'm right on the name. I'll say four.
Okay.
I think I also know who this author is, but I cannot for the life of me think of his book titles right now. So I'm going to turn it over to you.
All right.
Is it Chuck Palahniuk?
You got it.
Okay.
Wow.
So,
oh, that's not even. I was thinking Augustine Burroughs for some reason. Okay.
You guys are better at this than I thought you
were. I can definitely make some Chuck Palahniuk books.
I got to make these more challenging.
Fight Club and Choke.
Two. Those are the two movies.
Haunted.
That's three. And so that's four altogether. You got it. Fight Club, Survivor, Invisible Monsters, Choke, Lullaby, Diary, Haunted, Rant, Snuff, Pygmy, Tell All, and Damned. And then Invisible Monsters Redux. I would have counted that as well. Okay. So this next one, a little bit more challenging.
Tiebreaker.
Uh-oh.
Tiebreaker. Everyone's at 1 point. So we're either going to read World War Z or Our Man in Havana. So this is for all the marbles. Action goes to you. Author number three. She was alive.
That makes a difference.
She.
Let me say that. Was alive from 1775 to 1817. English. Her works, this is from Wikipedia, her works of romantic fiction set among the landed gentry earned her a place as one of the most widely read writers in English literature. One quote, "I don't want people to be very agreeable as it saves me the trouble of liking them a great deal." And she wrote 6 novels. How many can you name?
5.
You realize if you can't name 5, he gets the points.
I do.
Okay.
I have to imagine that if I'm right about who he is, about who she is, then she's probably thinking the same person and probably can do more than me. So I'll just have to hope that you fuck it up and pass. All
right. First, I'm going to volunteer who I think the author is. Jane Austen.
God damn.
Okay, that
that's not hard.
That
man.
Was my guess too,
dude.
But I just don't think I can do 4 books. All right,
ready. So there's Jane Austen. So that's 1. Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, Mansfield Park. I said 5, right?
You said 5. You gotta get one more.
Okay, hold on. So how much do I? I'm stalling here because I know that I've read a whole bunch of them. Shoot, there's another and. There's another something and something. Isn't there Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, Mansfield Park,
or...
Jane Austen, and oh my god, now I'm like,
this is for World War Z, come on.
I know, I want to read World War Z so bad. Emma.
She got it.
It just popped in at the last second.
Wow. You just made it too. I was just about to say.
Didn't Anne Hathaway made that movie?
Yes. No, Anne Hathaway played
Jane
Austen.
Oh, she made
the
biopic
thing.
Yeah.
Which has actually had nothing to do with Jane Austen's life whatsoever, because her books never became famous in her lifetime, which is something that was not really in the movie. They changed that.
So the two you didn't get, Northanger Abbey and Persuasion.
Yes.
She only wrote the 6 books?
Yep.
Yep.
Huh.
She had a couple that were other things, but not like novels. So
okay.
That's what I counted. All right. So you win World War Z.
Hope you guys like zombies.
Oh, I'm not upset.
Okay.
Yeah. That was a good choice.
Yes.
Okay.
So does this conclude the first inaugural meeting of the Absinthe Book Club?
Yeah.
ABC for those in the know.
Yeah. We call it the ABC. Pretty
yeah.
cool.
Well, let's cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers to Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Fear and Loathing, our first
cheers,
episode.
Cheers to drug binges.
Almost in the can.
And absinthe binges.
Oh, I didn't get my plug yet.
Oh, yeah, we got plugs. I almost forgot plugs.
Oh, yeah,
God
dude, plugs,
damn it.
Come on, Lex.
All right.
What's this whole thing about, bro?
Yeah, I know. I gotta get better at this. So let me just introduce that. Before we go, I'll give you guys a chance to plug something, because I know you're big, famous people in the know.
Mm.
All right, so Calvin, you get the first plug. Go.
Okay, so I co-host a monthly show in Park Slope, Brooklyn. It's a stand-up comedy show. I co-host it with Sharon Paul, who is a lovely and talented young lady. And it's the second Tuesday of every month, and it's always awesome New York lineups, a lot of people on the indie scene, like up-and-comer types, and then usually we throw in like a cool celebrity, like we've had Janine Garofalo, Sherry Shepherd, Gary Goldman and Ted Alexandro. Conquin's done it. Sharon books it. She's amazing. So, yeah, definitely worth the $5. Union Hall in Park Slope, Brooklyn.
Tuesday of every month.
Second Tuesday of every month, 8 p.m.
8 p.m. I can, I've been to it several times, and I can vouch. It is great.
Have you ever performed at it?
Yeah.
Sharon's in charge of the book.
I told you that, you know, I plugged my band for the Something You Should Check Out. Well, now I'm going to plug my blog, carrieshare.com. I write about all sorts of fun stuff. My most recent blog post was about how to reconcile your rock and roll lifestyle while still maintaining some sort of facade of being a responsible adult. Notable tips.
Important.
If you're drinking, put emergency, like I put, here's one of my fun tips, my rock and roll lifestyle tips. One of my favorite cocktails is vodka and water because it hydrates while it intoxicates. Lately, I've taken to adding packets of emergency into my vodka and water because that's an additional way to maintain health, I guess. I don't know. I just feel like maybe it can, you know.
So like a vodka OJ, but for the immune system.
Well, yeah, except it doesn't taste that good, but I think that it kind of counteracts the effects of maybe like the negative alcohol dehydration.
It's got vitamins.
It's got vitamins.
That's the key.
It's got vitamins. Yes.
A helpful tip. A helpful tip from Carrie Scher. And I think that'll about do it for our first episode. Let me again say thank you to the Astones for providing the music and Brian Eck for providing our cover art. And that is it for the first ever episode of the Absinthe Book Club. Next month, if you want to follow along, read World War Z. And
We should probably know the author's name.
Yeah, it was your pick.
It's not Brooks, is it?
There's an app for this. I don't know. World War Z. Bye. Hold on.
All right.
I know Mel Brooks' son wrote. Did he write World War Z?
Brooks.
I think he wrote the zombie
survival. It's the same guy who wrote
yeah.
the zombie survival.
I'm pretty sure it's Mel Brooks' son.
Mel Brooks is in the producers. Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah, by Max Brooks.
Yeah, they have Max Brooks.
Yeah,
Max Brooks.
All right. So that's what we'll be reading next month.
Zombies!
And we'll be commenting on it while we drink absinthe, and it'll be awesome. So check that out. All right. Thank you for listening. This is the Absinthe Book Club.
Goodbye.
Bye.
If you have questions or comments or suggestions for the show, please do email us at theabsinthebookclub@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @theabsinthebookclub. That's @theabsinthebookclub. Thanks for listening.